Accession number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 5.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 5. You were telling me about the selection of regiments and how it was done, Colonel.
Yes, and I think I was talking about Johnny MacDonald, who had joined with me literally right at the very beginning in Fort George. And Johnny, I'm fairly certain, had enlisted as a Cameron. But at Sandhurst, when you make your regimental choice, Johnny had put down Cameron. But he was summoned to London to meet the colonel of the Cameron Highlanders and the colonel of the Seaforth Highlanders, and was told quite categorically he was a MacDonald from Portree in the Isle of Skye. He would become a Seaforth, and there was no further discussion. Johnny then became a Seaforth, but one of the things of life, I suppose, is in fact in due course, of course, the Seaforths amalgamated with the Camerons and became the Queen's Own Highlanders, and so by that, I honestly don't know whether Johnny was still serving. Johnny sadly is now dead, but whether he was serving when that happened, I don't know. So, as I say, certainly early in your senior term, you knew where you were going. By this stage at Sandhurst, it's worth mentioning, we were the first intake to be issued with what was called number one dress, which was to be the post-war equivalent of mess kit and parade uniform. Pre-war they had a number of uniforms for various occasions. It was thought that post-war they would have one smart uniform that could be worn in the officer's mess or on parade. It was called number one dress. And at Sandhurst, it consisted of a blue peaked hat with a red band round it, blue uniform, blue tunic, blue trousers with a red stripe down each leg. It was a high collar, fastening at the top, white gorget patches, brass buttons. And you wore on parade a white belt as an ordinary cadet. Cadet under officers were provided with swords, and they used to go off in the early hours of the morning, sword drill, learning how to do sword drill. We ordinary soldiers were buff belts, which were an absolute nightmare. These were leather belts which had to be blankoed, and if it rained, the blanko went everywhere. Shortly, Enfield rifles with, again, white leather slings, bayonets in white leather frogs on your belt. That was always a favourite little trick if you were standing on parade ready to march on to one of these very high-powered ceremonial parades. When you spent, certainly as a junior and an intermediate, quite a lot of time getting your kit ready, because you were minutely inspected, which was all part of this character-building game. You would be standing there, and eventually you would be told to fix bayonets, and that's a drill movement where you go through, at one stage your left hand goes behind your back to where your bayonet is to get hold of it prior to pulling it out of its scabbard and putting it on your rifle. And of course the great lark was to extract somebody's bayonet from his scabbard at some stage before this, so that when the moment came to fix bayonets, you put your hand behind your back. And God save us, there was no bayonet. And occasionally, yeah, I mean, people went through one of these very large ceremonial parades without a bayonet on the end of their rifle. I mean, the sergeant major would know, but he'd know what would happen, and there was absolutely nothing he could do about it at that stage of the proceedings. And of course, on a parade ground with, I don't know, 800 rifles with bayonets on the end, one without a bayonet wasn't readily apparent.
Ceremonial parades, you mentioned, were these an annual event to commemorate some form of battle or action?
No, they were normally, there were two major ones. There was the, after, I think it was intake one, or it may have been 1A, the passing out parade was officially designated by the king, Sovereign's Parade. And so you had a Sovereign's Parade each term, and you had, the other one was normally, what do they call a banner parade? Because the Academy did have colours, and they were carried by the champion company. And so you had the parade, and that, the banner parade, was really a replication of Trooping the Colour, Brigade of Guards Trooping the Colour on Horse Guards. It was a very long parade. But they were both very impressive parades. You know, there were 900 of us there. As I say, by the time, in our senior term, we were issued with this number one dress, the blue uniform. And there was a mad panic to get it tailored and sorted out before our Sovereign's Parade, but eventually it was done. And so off we went, feeling very pleased with ourselves. And, I mean, it is an unforgettable experience to march onto the Academy Square in a great big phalanx of probably six abreast, onto the square. We were blessed on our Sovereign's Parade with quite reasonable autumn weather, or winter weather. And, it was a great experience. Being quite honest about it, we were slightly disappointed because the Sovereign's representative for our Sovereign's Parade was the Duke of Gloucester, who wasn't in the best of nick by that time. However, there we go. He appeared and did his stuff. And then, of course, right at the end, it really is quite emotional, although you don't think... emotional is a modern expression, I think. At the time, you realised you were going through a milestone in your life when the senior intake was under the portico, through the great big doors, and into the vestibule of the old building. And, of course, once you got in there, there were 300-odd people, swords and rifles and bayonets on the end, all being squashed in and all feeling very well pleased with themselves. And then you get the adjutant coming in behind you on his horse, right into the middle of this lot. However, it all sorts itself out. And off you go, and then that is when you pick up parents and have lunch, and then later on you're off on your passing out ball.
And your family came down to see you?
Oh, yes. It was a great family occasion. All the seats were laid out across the square and so on.
What date was this, Colonel?
This, 2nd of February, 1951. Yes, 2nd of February, 51.
Did you get leave before you moved to your unit?
Well, yes, you then went off on commissioning leave, and then you joined. People went various ways. Infantry people went to their infantry brigade training centre. Gunners, I think, all went to Lark Hill. Sappers all went to Chatham. Armour went to Bovington, and then in due course, some people, depending where the unit, where your unit was, if we stick to infantry and cavalry or armoured regiments, depending where they were, if they were in the Far East, in Hong Kong or somewhere like that, or in Korea indeed, because of course Korea was then in progress, you obviously did all your courses, your platoon commander's course and your weapons course, before you went off. If your battalion was in Germany or in UK, you tended to go to your battalion first and spend a bit of time there before coming back to do your platoon commander's course and your weapons course. And that's what I did. But as I say, infantry people went, in the first instance, at the end of your leave, you went to your, in that, at that time, infantry regiments were grouped into infantry brigades. And obviously we were part of the Light Infantry Brigade. And the Light Infantry Brigade training centre was at Borden, which was not a million miles away from Aldershot and Camberley. And I'd done my basic training at the Highland Brigade training centre at Fort George, where you had a training battalion. One of the battalions was the training battalion, and it was where all your national service intakes went through before going off to the battalion. And so we were, all the light infantry officers were told to go to the light infantry battalion at Borden. And it happened to be the Somerset. And I forget how many of us there were. Let's say half a dozen going to each of the light infantry regiments, which of course at that time were the Somersets and the Cornwalls and the Shropshires and the Yorkshire and the Durhams. And of course the thing that sticks in my mind was that we, all six of us, or however many it was, I think it was six, were put in the most appalling accommodation. It really was terrible, thinking about it now. Bearing in mind this was February, it leaked, it was dirty, it had coke stoves in, which we had to service if we wanted any form of heating. There was no hot water, and quite honestly, at that stage, we all said, well, cracky, if this is being an officer, I'm not sure this is a good idea at all. And I honestly can't remember what we did there. Not a lot, because we weren't there very long. Very shortly afterwards, it must have been a week or that sort of period of time, we all went off to our regimental depots. And I came to Brownsforth in Durham, just outside Durham. And that's when life really started, because I was met at the railway station by a soldier with a truck of some sort, and we went out to Brownsforth Castle. It was early evening, and I was met by the orderly officer, who explained that dinner was at whatever time it was, and that I should wear number one dress for that, and Private so-and-so would be my batman while I was there. And I was made to feel immediately, although I was a complete and utter stranger to everyone, that I was at home. Which was, as I say, that's where life started, really. I was taken up to my room, which was a vast room in Brownsforth. That was where the officers lived, and that's where the mess was. And the memorable thing, having come from this appalling accommodation in Borden, was the enormous great coal fire. Very large coal beside it, and so on. And I then had a bath and changed and went down to the anteroom. And as I say, it was a great feeling. As a complete and utter stranger, I was made to feel very welcome by everyone there. It was nice.
This was 1st Battalion?
No, this was the depot. This was the depot.
Who was commanding it?
Yeah, I thought you'd ask that. Jimmy Cousins, no. I think it was Charles Darcy Irvin.
And at the depot, what kind of things were you doing?
Well, at the depot, really, I was being introduced to the regiment. And I was trundled around Brownsworth Castle, because at that time that was where the regimental museum was, and so I trundled around that, and I met the quartermaster, and I met the RSM, and was taken into the sergeant's mess, and shown what was happening at the depot, which of course was really just a training machine for the National Service intakes. I was taken to the territorial battalions, all three, 6, 8 and 9. I was taken to the Regimental Association offices, which I've had a lot of discussion about this. They were, there was a legendary man called Colonel Harry Lowe, who was a quartermaster, or had been a quartermaster in the regiment, retired as lieutenant quartermaster, and he was secretary of the Regimental Association. And as I say, he was a legendary figure in the regiment. And I was taken to meet him. And his office was upstairs above an optician's on Elvet Bridge. And I can remember it quite clearly. Now, in my old age and senility generally, where I need glasses, I go to that optician's to get my glasses. And the first time I went, I knew that the man who was testing my eyes had been there forever, as far as I knew. And I said, "How long have you been here?" And he said, "Oh, since 1953 or something." And I said, "At that time, upstairs here was the regimental office of the DLI Association." And he said, "Oh, yes, yes." He said, "Oh, here you go, going back a bit." Well, of course I was. but then I've spoken to one or two other people who said, "Oh, no, no, it was in Brownsworth Castle. It was it wasn't there at all." In fact, it was. It was, for some reason, why it wasn't at the castle, I don't know. I just can't think. So, and I don't know how long I spent at Brownsworth.
Was this just a time of getting you into the
regiment? It was introducing me to the regiment, and by going round like that, obviously meeting a whole lot of people who'd been in the regiment for a long time, particularly the TA battalions, and the depot, by its nature, there were a lot of people from private soldier upwards who were very soldiers, who were posted to the depot for fairly quiet, comfortable life, having done great deeds somewhere else, you know. So it was the family home. It was as simple as that, really, and it was made very clear that was the family home. And that was nice.
And there was a conscious effort, in effect, to instill in you this regimental history.
Oh, yes, but I mean, in the nicest possible way. There was no indoctrination. I mean, there was no sitting in the depot commander's office being harangued and told anything, you know. Because they assumed, and quite rightly, that before you left Sandhurst, you'd done quite a lot of research into the regiment, so that you knew. I was just like anyone going to a new job, you find out as much as you can about the job before you start. It was as simple as that. And so whilst I didn't know them, obviously, but I, when people mentioned names and places and so on, I knew I had some sort of knowledge.
Did you have any duties in the depot whilst you were there?
No, not from memory. don't think I even did an ordinary officer. No, I was just a visitor. And then for, I think, probably Monday to Friday, I honestly can't remember, but I think probably Monday to Friday, and then after the weekend, back to the dreaded Borden. But again, only for a very short time. We all then went off to our battalions, wherever they happened to be. And the first battalion was in Dortmund at that time. And so, again, after a week's leave or whatever it was, I joined for the first time the great military movement machine that moved people backwards and forwards from Germany.
What time would this be?
What time? What you in February, March time? And you know, I mean, certainly I, maybe I was unusual, peculiar, I don't know, but I wore my battle dress and so on with a certain amount of pride, going off to join my battalion. My parents were living in London at the time, we went to Liverpool Street, and there was the great system. That's where the system started. And thinking about it now, it really was a very efficient system.
And how did it work, this system?
Well, I had a railway warrant and various documents. Turned up at the RTO's office in Liverpool Street Station, Railway Transport Office, presumably, RTO. And you clocked on there, and there was this great big train, and you got on this train with everybody else, and it went to Parkeston Quay in Harwich, where you got off the train, went to a transit camp, where, from memory, always, whatever time of day it was, it was always at the same time of the day in this particular transit camp, sort of early evening, I suppose, or 9 o'clock-ish, you had baked beans and fried egg and bacon. And then you walked from there down a gangway, up a gangway, onto a ship. And from memory, there were two ships, I think, but I can remember the HMT, Her Majesty's Troop of Vienna, was one of them. No, I can't remember the other. You got on the ship, and you had been told which cabin to go to, and you went to the cabin. It was either a big one with four people in it or a smaller one with two, whatever it was. You went to bed and you woke up the next morning at the Hook of Holland, where you got off the boat, having had breakfast on the boat. And there in the railway station were four enormous great trains. There was a red train, a white train, green train, a yellow train, and again, before you left Liverpool Street, you knew which train you were going on. See if I can get it right. The white one was going to Vienna, the red one was going to Berlin, the green one was going to Trieste, and the yellow one was going to, I don't know, somewhere in West Germany. And so you got on the appropriate train. Well, I was going to Dortmund at this stage, and so I got on, let's say, I think it was the green train, and off you. It was a military train. I mean, it was purely and simply run by the army. Obviously, it was a civilian driver and all the rest of it, but the whole thing was controlled by the army. And you got off wherever you had to get off, and I got off at Dortmund. And again, there was the order officer waiting for me with a wagon, and we got in this wagon and off to the barracks. And I can't remember the name. It was a large ex-German army barracks in Dortmund. And again, I arrived there early evening, and I was told dinner was at such and such time, wear number one dress, and that was that. And I was shown my room, which was very comfortable, and I was shown where the bathroom was, and I met one or two people milling around having baths and so on, and we just exchanged names and shook hands. In due course went down and had dinner. And again, it was, as a complete stranger, like joining a family. And it was, you know, very pleasant. There was no unpleasantness at all. Everyone was very pleasant. In fact, it was quite a small gathering because the battalion was literally on the move to Berlin. And so there was only half the battalion in Dortmund by that stage. The advance parties and everything had gone off to Berlin. But
who was commanding the battalion?
Commanding the battalion was Michael Hanmer, who had an illustrious war career, commanded the 6th Battalion, 9th Battalion at the end of the war. The Reichswald Forest, but he was already in Berlin, so I didn't meet him immediately. Second in command was Mark Leather, who had all. I mean, this, of course, was the thing at the time. We accepted it as part of life, but at that time, all the senior officers in the battalion had been through the war. A number of them had been brigadiers and so on, lieutenant colonels, and then it reverted back to substantive ranks at the end of the war, and down to company second in command level. They were all war experienced officers. It was really only second lieutenants and subalterns who were not. But Mark Leather was there and, as second in command, and I met him, obviously. The thing I always remember about Dortmund, I mean, we were only there for a fortnight before we pushed off to Berlin, was sitting in my room, looking out over the Ruhr, and it was all going, you know, blast furnaces, and it's rather like a very, I suppose, quite a small imitation of Teesside as it is nowadays. But there it was, the industrial heartland of West Germany, as it was, with the main road running outside the barracks. Anyway, it was the first time I'd been out of England, apart from anything else. And in the fortnight I was there, or 3 weeks that I was there, I think it was only a fortnight, there was quite a lot of social activity, farewell parties here and farewell parties there. And, of course, a thing that I was not used to was the accessibility of hard liquor, you know, spirits and so on, because it was dirt cheap. And I'd never come across it before. And so there was a certain amount of hilarity. But it was all part of the process of growing up. And, again, with hindsight, one realizes one was being looked after by one's mates, although you'd only been there a short time. You weren't allowed to get into any particular trouble, and so that was all right. And Dortmund, it really was just packing up, literally. You know, I was put into A Company, but everyone was so busy packing up and doing duties, various things, that I didn't meet a platoon as such. And then eventually we got on a train, which, as was the army's custom at the time, moved in dead of night up to Berlin. We arrived in Berlin early morning, and out to Wavell Barracks in Spandau.
What were your expectations of Berlin?
Never having been out of the country before, you just had no... I had no concept. It's like saying to someone, what's it like going to Peking or Rio de Janeiro? But certainly, the little... In Dortmund, we didn't go out into the town as such, because it was 1951, and so... whilst the war had been over for a while, we were still very much an army of occupation. We didn't have any marks, we didn't have any Deutschmarks. We were still using British Army money. And so you couldn't go into a German pub to have a drink or anything, not that you'd be very welcome. Obviously at that stage there was still quite a lot of hostility. In Dortmund and the Rhineland, Berlin was different, because they had been through the airlift by that time, and they knew which side their bread was buttered, and they appreciated that the presence of the French and the Americans and the British in Berlin, that was their defence. And so Berlin, as far as the civilians were concerned, completely different atmosphere.